You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Vince, take two. Here we are 3 days after the first attempt at recording this, but you had some power issues.
Yes. Thank you, Marty. Take two. Take two indeed. Yeah, so we had a couple blackouts in the area. One was from the storm and one was from before the storm.
Hey, early, I was texting you early June blackouts. Not a good sign before summer even kicks off.
That's right. I think they're going to put a data center in the Starbucks next door to me.
Legitimately, or is that a...
No, that's bullshit, but that would be funny. Why not? Starbucks become a data center.
Everybody's become a data center. It's the add blockchain to your name and see your stock price rise. But we're not here to talk about all that. We're here to talk about your new book, which is called As Good as Gold, The Return to Real Money. And you were really beginning to get going during the first take of this episode on Friday, when we just started with the concept of collateral versus currency. You believe the system runs...
Yeah.
Collateral, not currency, and how you have these different properties of money. And you're explaining how gold was the store of value, medium of exchange, and unit of account for a long time. But they began to slowly but surely and methodically detach each property from gold, specifically medium of exchange and unit of
account. That's right. The collateral approach, yeah. Why the collateral approach behind the book? Most books talk about money. They talk about currencies. They talk about central banks or interest rates. What I wanted to do was focus on the thing underneath all those collateral. The thing that's underneath all those is trust. But absent the trust, you've got to go with collateral. So the insight that drove the book is that every monetary system in history ultimately depends on what society trusts enough to pledge against debt. And this is definitely... in the Bitcoin camp, for centuries, that asset was gold, right? So in the modern era, it became U.S. Treasury securities. And, you know, the book explains how that transition occurred and why it mattered. And then the transition occurred starting with Bretton Woods, which is what we were talking about. You see, the question, I think you asked me a question. You said, what gave me the idea to write it? I think that's what you asked me. And the answer is about 4 years ago, I was writing some of the questions from the lines of questions for the Frank Giustra, Michael Saylor debate on Bitcoin. I was involved in writing some of the lines of questions for that. And during that, I gave myself a very deep education on the three definitions of money, which any Bitcoin person knows what they are, you know. Medium of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. And during that, I did a little history search, and it was current events with the Bitcoin debate going on back then. But I did a little history search, and the history search said, well, before Bretton Woods, gold was all three. Money was all three, store of value, medium of exchange, and unit of account. And then when Bretton Woods started, they went off the gold standard, even though that we all allegedly still had our gold, and the dollar became the medium of exchange. So the gold is still the store of value, right? They peeled off medium of exchange, and they peeled off unit of account. And then in 71, when Nixon blew up Bretton Woods, we went off of gold altogether. So if you look at the three definitions of money, and you hear the debate about the dollar is going to be dethroned. I don't think it is going to be dethroned, and I don't give a shit. You know, I mean, I don't care about you know whatever theory you have about the milkshake boys or whatever other dairy confection that we're using to describe the dollar. But to be fair to that concept, they're not going to stop using dollars. They're going to start using stablecoin dollars or digital dollars, you know, and that's where things like gold and actually down the road, you know, I think maybe Bitcoin will have a chance to be the collateral that's used for these transactions. Anyway, so collateral, the central argument of the book is that we're living through a collateral transition, not necessarily a currency transition. So most people debate whether the dollar will remain dominant. I think the more important question is what assets the world trusts as collateral, because we don't trust people anymore. So if confidence in treasury securities changes at the margin, the system doesn't disappear, but it may evolve toward a more diversified collateral framework where gold plays a bigger role, where even silver plays a role. And down the road, I think Trojan horse willing, Bitcoin would play a role.
Yeah, and I think it's being validated in real time too. And we were discussing this briefly on Friday, but I think we should expand on it. I mean, the ECB came out and confirmed that gold has overtaken treasuries as the world's top reserve asset, as the top collateral asset, with gold at 27% of reserves and treasuries is 22%. And
it's funny how they do that. The ECB all of a sudden is telling us something that we've known for about a year now. But why are they doing that all of a sudden? I think the ECB is shitting themselves because they're worried about stablecoin dollars coming in. I mean, I'm looking at it as an ulterior, like a Tom Luongo ulterior motive. Like they're talking the dollar down. That's what the ECB is doing. And they're telling the truth. But the fact that they're underlining it now, why would you underline it now? I mean,
well, I'm sure you've seen Christine Lagarde's comments on stablecoins too. I think she and Ursula von der Leyen, they both come out and explicitly said U.S. dollar stablecoin expansion into markets outside the U.S. is bad for the euro. And they've got this really big push to get the digital euro. They don't want a euro stablecoin backed by some private issue or like Tether or Circle. Right. They want to get their digital euro to market, which will be a creation of the European Central Bank and I assume the European Union or European Parliament as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they are definitely shitting themselves, for lack of a better word, because, you know, whether you think it's going to work or not, it is a valid idea. If you give people a choice, and they have a wallet, and in that wallet, that literal wallet, they have a stable coin or a euro, they might use a stable coin. Because, I mean, an example that I used with someone else was, let's say you wanted to buy something in Europe and you were going into your wallet and you're going to use a digital euro. Well, if you're using a digital euro and you wanted to buy something that might be questionable, maybe they won't let you buy it. Maybe they'll put the kibosh on it. Or, I mean, using the Bitcoin example, okay? I'm standing inside Europe, and I pull out my wallet to buy Bitcoin. And when I do that, it goes through the European Central Bank. They know I have Bitcoin. It's been vetted, or who knows what they can do with it. Meanwhile, if I get in my car and drive, you know, 5 miles outside of the border, I can just buy it with the stablecoin and not have any problems. So it's not going to be good for them either way.
No, I think they're scared shitless for a reason. And I think they need very fine control over everything happening within their monetary system because they're losing control of their economies to a certain extent. I don't think they've innovated. And obviously, ESG mandates have really hollowed out the strong energy base, which has hollowed out the manufacturing base, particularly in Germany, and they're looking at social and cohesion because of the migration crisis that is bubbling, particularly in the UK and all across Europe, really. And I think they see the social tensions rising and they really want to clamp down on speech and use of money as well.
Yeah, I mean, they have to close the doors and windows that they can while they keep everything under control, but it's all precipitated by them. During COVID, they let German manufacturing leave. They encouraged it to leave. They started preaching this WEF, what's the word they used? Not net zero, something worse. basically anti-capitalism. I forget what it was.
Stakeholder capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. And then they let all the immigrants in, which I'm not saying that I agree with it. I don't agree with it. But I do understand what the motivation was. I just think it's a horrible motivation. And I think they're just causing, they're going to cause a culture clash, which means that basically everything the government does is, and I'm speaking, as a libertarian in this matter, everything the government does is cause a problem and then they sell you the solution or it gives them an excuse to have more of a power grab. We're going to let a million immigrants in and then we're going to take away free speech because we don't want the immigrants to be bothered. Meanwhile, they're all running around with machete swords. I mean, I'm not like a militant on this stuff, but it's ridiculous. It's too much.
It's observable, I think, is the most politically correct way to say it, right?
It's observable, yeah.
Don't tell me not to believe my lying eyes. But bringing this back to collateral and really sort of tying the knot on this and going back to what the ECB admitted, that gold has overtaken treasuries as collateral. And again, I think really driving on the juxtaposition of currency and collateral, because what we're talking about US dollar dominance, but what's really underlying that dominance is what people
treasuries
use for collateral, which is treasuries, right?
Right.
And so really trying to paint the picture of how the currency and the collateral in the existing incumbent fiat system work and how you imagine that transition.
That's that's the next book, right? I mean, if let's say I have my way and everyone's going to be using dollars, but no one's going to be using treasuries or not using as many treasuries. What is going to happen then? Well, what's going to happen is that the collateral will be whatever you transfer into dollars. So I'm going to have my stablecoin dollar, and I'll have some of my portfolio in gold collateral, some of my portfolio in Bitcoin collateral, some of my portfolio in treasury collateral. And maybe that's what it is. But it's just the end of treasury dominance. The dollar can still dominate. But, I don't think currency really matters. That's a very naive thing to say. But I mean, when you look at the history of currency, currency can be the most. Look, what did the United States government do during that time after Bretton Woods? They successfully fused the currency to the store of value. They said the treasury is the dollar. The treasury is the dollar. And so gold's not in the picture anymore. And so that worked for 50 years. Now it's like, well, the treasury isn't the dollar. We're still going to use dollars, but we're not going to use treasuries for collateral. What are we going to use? And I think people talk about this multipolar concept, multipolar currencies. It's really multipolar collateral. It's like, what are you going to guarantee? Like, I'm going to trade dollars with you. And you're going to say, well, Vince, what's backing your dollars up? And I'm like, well, I've got Bitcoin. I've got Ethereum. I've got gold. I've got silver. I got a basket.
Well, when you're describing in that way, I'm thinking of, I'm 35, just turned 35. I've been hyper aware and following the developments in the global financial system since 2008. Went and studied economics at college, worked at a fund, obviously Bitcoin, a lot of the tangential topics that I follow are related to geopolitical and macroeconomic developments over the years. And I think particularly in the, in the Bitcoin space and the hard money space, in the more free market minded space, people have been screaming that you're going to have this sovereign debt melt up, where you're going to have this calamitous sort of blow up of sovereign debt markets, and we're just going to have a reset button. But I think what you're putting forth is, it seems like they're prepping the transition to be more sort of structural, methodical, and less chaotic. Is that what you think is happening quietly behind the scenes with this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, I think they've seen how they screwed up before, and they're going to do a controlled takedown. We're doing a, I've used the analogy of an engine swap. The economy is a car driving down the road, and they recognize that the current engine that they have isn't working anymore. And so they need to swap engines and put a new engine in. But meanwhile, they can't stop the car. So they're telling everybody everything is fine while they're tinkering under the hood, going at 80 miles an hour, trying to swap the engine. So it's a controlled takedown is probably a better way to look at it. But the engine analogy, I think, yeah, it works. It works for me. But the controlled takedown is what you're describing. I think that's absolutely what's going on now. They know it's coming. I mean, look, they put out a paper in 2000 saying that they need to increase immigration into Europe. Like, that paper's out there. Yeah. I read that. I'm like, oh, okay. So they plan for this. They're planning for everything. I mean, they may not be good at it, but they are planning for everything. I agree. You're right.
That's Alex Jones propaganda. The UN wrote that paper, but we're not allowed to talk about it. What do they call it? The great replacement theory is what you're pushing right now.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, I read the whole paper. It was interesting because they had a list of basically three things that they wanted to do to deal with it. And the reason that they wanted the immigration or the great replacement was because they didn't have enough working people to carry the Ponzi scheme. But meanwhile, they're not encouraging anyone to have kids. So we're just importing immigrants, which, okay, fine. If they want to be there and they want to be there for the right reason, that's fine. But they didn't. They just want to be there to stir up some shit, it would seem. But that's one thing. So the replacement people, replace people with immigrants, raise the retirement age. Retirement age is going to go up to, I think it's like 62 at the earliest in the U.S. That's going to go up to 70, maybe 75. And it's not going to happen all at once. But one day you and I are going to wake up and we're going to say, oh, look at that. The retirement age is 70 now. And they will have changed it. They're definitely going to do everything to slow down retirees.
Well, Silicon Valley is working hard to extend lives. I mean, we're going to all live to be 150. So it's just natural that
that's right.
You retire.
That's right. 70. I was thinking about that.
Then
I think the darker point is, I guess, well, if you're in Canada, they start selling suicide booths. So
did you hear the story about the guy at Tim Hortons the other week?
No.
There was some guy, Canadian, sitting outside like a Tim Hortons, and some like social worker noticed he was in a bad mood. Apparently he had irritable bowel syndrome, and
right.
he talked to this Canadian, I guess, social worker or doctor connected to the state in the parking lot. And they decided then and there that he was probably, it was probably time for him to participate in the MAID program and euthanize himself, and did it like the next day.
Wait, this is true?
Yes.
A guy is sitting in a parking lot, gets approached by a state-sponsored doctor, and offs himself within days?
Yeah.
You got to give me the link to that. That's crazy.
Let me see if I can pull it up real quick.
I mean, you know, for later, I'll send it to my subscribers just because it's just so bizarre. I'd have to send it to them.
Yeah.
And of course, it's Tim Hortons, right? Which makes sense.
Yeah, right. But back to the reason we're talking here. How does the plumbing come in all this? Like repo markets, rehypothecation. You're making the analogy of the engine. The economy is this engine that's running and we have to change it on the go. Well, we're going 80 miles an hour. And I feel like a lot of the critical parts that are necessary for that engine exist in these markets that are very opaque, or maybe not opaque, but very hard to understand.
Right.
For the layman, and what is their particular interaction and relationship to collateral, and how does that evolve over time?
Right. The repo markets, the rehypothecation, you know, the short version is that most people think the global financial system runs on money, but my argument is actually runs on collateral. And the book traces how we got here, which is what you're talking about, right? We went from a world where gold was the ultimate settlement asset to a world where treasury bonds became the backbone of global finance. I walk readers through the evolution of that system and explain concepts like repo markets, dollar recycling, and rehypothecation in a way that non-specialists can understand. But the second half of the book asks the question, what happens when confidence in that collateral begins to change? But the repo, these are all the things that were structured or created post Bretton Woods, to facilitate the treasury market being the backstop of everything. Repo, you don't have to sell your treasuries. You can just give them to us and we'll give you cash for them. So things like that. The plumbing has been set up to support the treasury market. And now we need a new plumbing system to support this multipolar collateral world that we're entering into.
Well, and this is something that we discussed, I think, when you first came on, because I had you on last fall to discuss the gold on warrant at the Shanghai Gold Exchange. And that, like, we went walked through that and basically setting up all the gold vaults in the different countries across Southeast Asia and parts of Eastern Europe and the Middle East. And now that you're explaining that about the repo market, it seems like that's the parallel sort of repo.
It is the parallel that's set up. That's a great connection to make. It is the parallel. The parallel is that if you want to repo treasuries, you press a button and you can, for those who don't understand what a repo is basically throwing your collateral into the pawn shop and then getting cash for it. So that's repurchasing. And then you have rehypothecation, which is everyone is familiar with in gold, and Bitcoin is getting familiar with now as well, with the manufacturing of futures, keep the price of an asset suppressed. But when you tie it to the vaults, I mean, look, one of the things that the dollar has going for it that gold does not, at least not yet, not legally, even though it is something called HQLA, which is high quality liquid asset, which is a label. And that label says if something is liquid enough, we give it that label. And if it's that liquid, then it's also eligible for repo. So as long as gold in the West is not HQLA, whatever that label means, you can't use it for repo. And if you use it for repo, you'd be competing with treasuries. So they don't want to do that. So going back to the China thing, what China and the BRICS have done is they said, well, we want gold to be HQLA. We want gold to be repoable. And we're going to physically set up vaults to that effect. So one of the negotiations was with Saudi Arabia. The Chinese said, listen, we want you to use yen. I mean, yuan. And the Saudis said, sure, but we don't want it. We don't trust your currency. We want to convert it into gold. So China said, fine. And then they said, well, what if we want to use the gold for collateral for something else? You guys have our gold. And China said, fine, keep the gold in a vault in your country. And so they started creating this network of vaults. And so now everyone's got control of their own gold. They can use it as collateral, and then they can borrow money against it, and they can build infrastructure and highways. I mean, that's kind of what's been going on in Africa, what Dorsey was trying to do with Bitcoin, you know, get people to use it as an infrastructure rebuilding tool in Africa. But the Middle East is doing that with gold now. So they're basically saying to a country like Ghana, you've got a lot of gold. You don't have any roads or highways. If you put the gold in your vault and that vault's part of our network, then we'll let you borrow against it, repo against that gold to build highways. Now, the trick of it is the Chinese love this because they're going to be hiring Chinese companies to rebuild the highways. So basically, that's how China's manufacturing gets legs in the Belt and Road Initiative. That's pretty powerful stuff. That's the new plumbing.
It is. And do you think the U.S. recognizes this and is trying to counteract it? I think Scott Bessent, actually, it's probably good that your power went out on Friday, because I believe later that day, Scott Bessent was on the Hill and Tim Scott was asking him questions about the state of digital asset policy. And Scott Bessent, unprovoked, said the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve Act is very high priority. It's moving slowly, but they're trying to act methodical and make sure they get everything right. And
I mean, I think when it comes to Bitcoin itself, I think what I really think is in the future, you're going to have whatever currency you want to use, yuan, yen, euros, dollars, and what backs that currency is going to be what gives your currency its value. So I'm not talking about a gold standard or anything like that, or a Bitcoin standard, but I am saying that, you know, if I have stable coins, Genius Act, and what's the new name, the new act called?
The Clarity Act.
Yeah, the banks are already rebelling against it. The banks are a little bit nervous about it now. So I think Bessent is familiar with it. And I think there's a clock There's a clock on the dollar's dominance that's starting to run out. And they know that they need to use whatever tool they can get, whether that be Bitcoin, whether that be gold. I mean, I don't think they want to use gold, but they have to use gold eventually. But if they can get stable coins and Bitcoin in the stable to get this going, then what they'll do is they'll put dollars in everyone's hands in stablecoin fashion. And so that's going to be good for Bitcoin eventually.
Yeah. Now, as we're thinking about it, it's like, how scarce are these? Like, how big is this for the gold and Bitcoin markets in terms of future price appreciation?
Well, you know, I don't have an answer for that, but I do know, I mean, we do know that we both know that Tether has been buying gold as well as Bitcoin now. And I can't think that they're doing it just because they're speculating. You know, and I'm not sure, they don't have the business yet, you know, for gold stable coins, but they certainly have the gold now. So, I mean, they're buying as much
as
they
have a gold stable coin.
What?
They have a gold stable coin.
They do, but I mean, it's not all deployed. I'm just saying that they have all this gold and they're not buying it as a spec. So they're hedged, they're properly run. I mean, that's what's going to happen. I'm going to be in Europe one day and, I'm going to buy a bottle of wine and I'm going to pull out my wallet. My wallet's going to be a U.S. stablecoin and I'll pay with a U.S. stablecoin and my stablecoin will be my U.S. dollar stablecoin will be backed by whatever I use for collateral. And that's it. Or maybe I'll use it in, you know, if you're in China, you'll be using, you know, yuan, but it won't be a stablecoin. It'll be a digital yuan. So, I mean, they're trying to fight that off, but I agree. Bessent is, I'm a fan of him. I mean, he can be off the reservation sometimes, but I'm a fan of him in that he's at least bringing digital along the way it should be brought along, because we recognize now that digital is not the enemy of the dollar. Digital is going to be the thing that makes the dollar survive. At least I think.
So, freaks, this report was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. Guys, things happen. Things get lost. You need to replace your phone. Life happens. And BitKey has been designed with this in mind. So if you're looking for the easiest way to secure your Bitcoin off the exchange, go get a BitKey. It doesn't come with any seed phrases. There's no single point of failure. It's a 2-3 multi-sig. You have your device. You have the mobile app and block stores a key in the server. So you have collaborative multi-sig there. On top of that, the new BitKey has a screen. So you can actually see and verify what you're approving. You can look at transactions, addresses, account changes. The difference between trusting and knowing has been built into the new BitKey with the screen. They've changed code delegation and other advanced features like inheritance, recovery. If you're looking to get your Bitcoin off exchange, you haven't done so, and you're looking for the easiest way to do that, go get a BitKey. You can use our code today, TFTC, to get 10% off the new BitKey. So go download the BitKey app, use the code TFTC to get 10% off the new BitKey and start your self-custody journey today. This episode has been sponsored by our good friends at BitKey.
Sup, freaks. This rep is brought to you by our good friends at Lygos Finance, Celsius, BlockFi, FTX. They took your Bitcoin and gambled it away. Lygos can't because they never hold it. Non-custodial lending on Bitcoin's base layer. Your keys, your collateral. It's verifiable on-chain. Go to Lygos.finance. Tell them that TFTC sent you.
I mean, this gets into, I think, a really important question. Is the plan that the powers that be have to re-architect this collateral system on the go, is that overall beneficial for humans, for humanity, for, let's just use the U.S. perspective, for U.S. citizens? Or is it going to lead to a finer ability to control prices and the financial system and extend that to speech? And
you're talking about stable coins or central bank digital currencies? Or both?
Both. Stable coins. Because I'm also thinking that's like, there's three paths. CBDC, central banks control it. You get your allowance, can't buy meat, all that good stuff.
Right.
Stable coins, privately issued, backed now by treasuries, but in your view in the future will be backed by a sort of portfolio of collateral, different collateral, Bitcoin, gold, treasuries, whatever it may be. More free market than central bank digital currencies. However, as we've seen in the Strait of Hormuz over the last month, like still essentially controlled. Yes, they run on peer-to-peer distributed blockchains. However, They are centrally issued by a third party, in many cases Tether. And if the U.S. government comes to Tether and says, hey, we got word that this actor that we don't like has a bunch of Tether, we need you to hit button to freeze the Tether in that account. So you still have the functionality of a CBDC with the stable coin. So however, it's just got a friendlier free market, private market.
There's the illusion of there's the illusion of separation of church and state, you know, like, oh, JP Morgan isn't going to do what the government wants. They're not going to stop me from buying, you know, beer with my stable coin. And maybe the government's going to say, well, you're right. Maybe we're not. So, and JP Morgan won't stop us, but JP Morgan will raise the minimums. JP Morgan, like there's going to be the companies will comply with the state. I agree with you. It just won't be as ham-fisted or ham-handed or obvious. But if you're big enough and you're on their radar, they'll come and get you. We've already seen it, as you said.
Well, do you see a third path where you you lean into Bitcoin specifically, which can't be controlled, and you use it as a you use all aspects of the properties of money that we described earlier, store value, medium of exchange, unit of account, and where it becomes
it's look, I mean, I'm a gold person, and my education on Bitcoin, little of it that I own, tells me that, you know, if you look at money a certain way and you are willing to operate money a certain way, then Bitcoin's a better solution for all of that. So that would be your third way. But what I'm woefully ignorant of is, or what I'm not ignorant of is how the government will control on-ramps and off-ramps and kind of capture. That's what governments do. They just capture. So there's always going to be the sovereign individual who gets to use Bitcoin outside of the system. But for most of humanity, it's going to be captured. So,
well, it comes in like waves, right? Like sine waves. And that's what I'm trying to discern. Like, are we getting like peak government capture? And does the power of the state collapse in and of itself via a sovereign debt crisis, via social uprising where people are upset with the Epstein class? They've had enough and they truly stand up to the federal government, which is taxing us at a rate of like 25x more than what the British Empire was taxing the colonies at before they incited the revolution. And
I see your point.
If they do corral more power and they already have a lot of power, it's like what is the point of diminishing marginal returns on trying to acquire and exert that power? And like, when is it collapsing?
You're talking about the philosophy behind revolution.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about. So I have to go now. I don't want to get arrested. No, but I've been reading about some of that from, there's an old, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, but let me just say what she said. Her name is Hannah Arendt. She said that with comments on power and violence, she made the comment that governments, when they lose the respect and the authority of their people, they will seek to overreach by squeezing too hard, and that's when you get your revolution. So when you said that, I'm like, it sounds like you're reading Hannah Arendt. She was, whoever she was a philosopher. And she was describing basically that the government and the people is always a battle between centralization on one hand and decentralization on the other. Or you can look at it as control by the state and libertarianism. So, but that's the way it always goes. And so as the states, and this is like this plays right into the Bitcoin stuff, as the state's power weakens from new technologies that fragment its central power, it will try and squeeze harder, like censorship. That's an example of them trying to squeeze harder inappropriately. And eventually, what happens is they either win or lose, but if they win, they lose anyway, because that's where you get your revolution. So to bring it back to Bitcoin, Did you ever see that show, Mr. Robot?
Yes.
Okay, so Mr. Robot was about a crisis. I mean, part of the show was about a crisis. And I remember watching that going, well, they tried to install their own version of a corporate Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was e-money,
e-coin,
whatever it was. It was the evil empire money. But that's what's going to happen. I mean, I believe that for evolution, the evolution of money will have revolutions in it. And one of those revolutions will be a crisis like Mr. Robot, where people have to find something that's better. I mean, better than gold. I mean, and I say that because who's going to be using gold? Who's going to be using a gold stablecoin to go buy a ham and cheese on rye? I mean, that's just not happening, you know. So Bitcoin is well suited for that. The question is, what causes mass adoption? And usually it's a crisis. We need a crisis for someone to say, oh, shit, I got to do something different. People don't change their habits unless they have to. So.
No, I want to be clear. I'm not calling for revolution. I'm just running through the logical thought experiment. I don't think you are. It does make you wonder. Like, you're looking out, you know, Western, quote unquote, democracies and seeing the fists get tighter around the people. I mean, I think it's more exacerbated in Europe now, particularly the UK, Ireland, parts of Germany,
yep.
Particularly with anti-immigrant sentiment really clamping down and that whole tragedy in England over the last few weeks where that white kid was killed and the cops handcuffed him because his murderer claimed that the kid was being racist to him and they let him die on the street. And people are getting pissed off. And if you're tweeting about it, the UK law enforcement's going to come knock on your door and give you a stern warning. And eventually they'll throw you in jail for a couple months.
What did you think was going to happen? I mean, this is why I'm so scared of how stupid governments are, you know, to bring back the point of they'll overreach when they start to lose the respect of the people around them. How stupid do you have to be to not see that letting in millions of people is not going to cause a culture clash, and enforcing these rules and having morons enforce them? I'm like beside myself with how do they, my conclusion is either they're dumb and most of them are dumb, or the ones that aren't dumb say, I don't care. Just hammer the square peg into the round hole until it fits. I don't care what you do to the edges of the peg, it's going to happen. So that's where you get your V for Vendetta revolution.
Yeah. I mean, then here in the States, I mean, we're not at that level, anywhere near that level, I would say. Yeah. And I think speech is still relatively free, but then you have like other aspects of it. Like we have a wartime footing. And yes, there is a war going on, but it's not like World War II time footing where like the Trump administration is going out and buying large pieces of equity in critical businesses. So you have like this quasi nationalization of some right. industries across the country too. And that's a little creepy to me.
That's creepy. For me, that's creepy because in the beginning you're like, I'm long that stock. That's good. And after like 6 months, you're like, wait a minute, that's fucked up, you know, cause then they can tell them what to do. Oh, they're rewarding a contract for them. Yay. And you're like, wait a minute, that's not good. That's not good for us. That's state control. You know, I had read something 4 years ago, actually taught my students this, and it's playing out just as it was predicted back then. And it was, the conversation was, the world is going towards centralized authoritarian governments because they're losing control technologically of people. So they're overreaching, that whole overreaching concept. And it said it started in China. And the guy says, well, I mean, I said, basically, the U.S. went into China and said, if they accept capitalism, they'll accept democracy. And China said, we like capitalism. We use that. And then they had Tiananmen Square. And we're not accepting democracy. Screw that. So instead of us exporting democracy to China, China is now exporting authoritarian despotic rule to Europe. That's what's happening in Europe. And we've got to keep it on that side of the Atlantic. But I think there's a problem.
All right, freaks. You know me. You know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up. The Aven Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No gains, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aven never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there, or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR. For a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity, it's hard to beat. I mean, the duration and the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game. If you've been stacking for years and you need liquidity without triggering a taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aven.com/Bitcoin. That's AVEN.com/Bitcoin. Check it out.
What's up, freaks? When you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their motto is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. And it always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
I think the AI race is accelerating its inclusion in American policy, right? Because the AI race has been deemed existential by the current administration. And I think, like, directionally, like, it is correct. It's a big pie, and there's very severe consequences for not winning the AI battle. And it is existential to an extent, but I think the free market, we should let the entrepreneurs go do it. The government trying to put their hand on the scale and really put money and get equity positions in these companies. And you can squint and see the regulatory moats beginning to be drafted and some dark rooms on the Hill and license regimes coming. And I think the AI race is an example of that authoritarianism beginning to creep in the US from China, because China is the number one sort of competitor that we have in that specific race.
Right.
And I think a lot of people in the US government and even in the tech sector have basically thrown their hands up and say, hey, we have to be more like China to beat China in this particular race.
Right. That started under Biden. I remember him saying something to that effect. He's like, you know, democracy, we've had it too easy. We need to turn the aircraft in the water or something like that. Aircraft carrier in the water. But yeah, I get it. We're centralizing authority to be able to compete with a central authority. So in a sense, democracy is messy, and we can't afford to be messy right now. And so we're signing on for corporatism or fascism or whatever it is. But it's dangerous.
It's funny. I've been rereading Democracy, the God That Failed. And I think Hoppe made some really good poignant points in that book.
I didn't hear the last part you said. Your voice is a little low.
I said I've been rereading Democracy, the God That Failed. And I think Hoppe has some really interesting points in that book.
I never read that. What's the central point?
It's essentially a thought experiment. He's comparing democracies to monarchy. And he says it in the introduction. I don't think monarchy is the ideal form of government, but we're going to walk through the thought experiment of comparing democracies to monarchies, and I'm going to highlight why monarchies are superior. And the core thesis basically revolves around monarchs have in a legitimate equity stake. Like they're landowners, they own a lot of the productive capital within their domain, and they have a duty to their domain. And monarchies, particularly hereditary monarchies, where you pass down through the family, you have the ability to think with a low time preference, because your reputation and ultimately your head is dependent on you stewarding that capital and allocating it efficiently to make sure that the people living within your domain are relatively well off and productive. Whereas with a democracy, you don't have that ability because you have politicians cycling through every 4, 8, however many years, and they don't have the same sort of dedication to the capital that they're stewarding, and that they can always hand the bag on to somebody else.
Right. You can, in a democracy, a politician only has to worry about the short term, because the long term takes care of itself. The invisible hand will take care of it. Well, it's not taking care of it anymore. We definitely have some problems that need to be addressed. That's interesting. So the monarch has skin in the game. And so it's in his best interest to run it right. Or the despot, or the dictator. And I don't mean that in a negative way, the person who's in charge. If there's some, it's kind of like the Batman movie. Here's an analogy for you. The Batman movie, when they're sitting at the table, the Joker one, we're sitting at the table and what's his name? The guy who ends up being Two-Face. He says,
Harvey Dent.
He says, well, back in Roman times, when there was crisis, they would make someone a Caesar, and that person would run the show until they got the crisis taken care of. And then they go into the whole thing. Well, then either you live long enough to be hated or get killed by your people or something like that. But that's the idea. We need a leader right now. The question is, you know, it's who is the leader?
We need a Cincinnatus. Somebody who will come from the farmland, get everything in order, and then go back to his humble farm. Your people
right,
are saying,
right. That's your Caesar. Cincinnatus is your Caesar. Yeah. That's right.
It is crazy times, and can be discombobulating at times. But I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this. I know, you're a gold guy, but that's the one thing that gives me confidence, or maybe not confidence, but relative calm. And it's like, I know what Bitcoin is. I know what I own. I know who cannot be controlled, rather trivially. And I think that sort of rule set and that anchor, it gives me a lot of peace of mind. It's like, okay, worst comes to worst, I can allocate in this asset that is out of the control of the central banks or the states, and I'm relatively inoculated. I think gold can't make as strong an argument for it, but it's pretty strong. You know, if
people I understand. You know, if you fully believe the premise that Bitcoin can't be co-opted, and from everything I've seen, that's true, then eventually there'll be an opportunity for it, and it will slip in and become money. Do I feel that way about gold? I largely feel that way about gold. My concern about something like gold is I think that it can be co-opted in a sense where it could be the on-ramps and off-ramps can be restricted. You know, if I'm using a stable coin, or I'm not going to go to a deli and buy a ham and cheese on rye, you know, with a gram of gold. Similarly, I think Bitcoin, the on-ramps and off-ramps within our society or the U.S. society can be compromised, and you can survive on that. You're not going to have that taken from you, but would you be able to use it? I mean, these are obvious questions I'm asking and everyone asks. The question is, you know, the more the government overreaches, I'm thinking about Bitcoin here specifically, gold too, but Bitcoin, the more the government overreaches, the more they create their own competition. Because there's going to be a black market. There's going to be an alternative way to do things. And that's where Bitcoin comes in. So, yeah.
Yeah. How are they going to try and control Bitcoin? I mean, you mentioned futures launching.
Well, they're doing that now. I mean, I don't think it's a high priority right now, but I think well, with gold, when they created the futures market for gold, that tamped it down. And they created the futures market in 2017 for Bitcoin, and that tamped it down. In fact, it made it crash back then. I contend that's what happened. And now they have it in an ETF, and they love ETFs. And so, yeah, you may think you own Bitcoin, but you own the wrapper that goes around the Bitcoin that BlackRock is rehypothecating with someone else. I mean, so they're going to keep it down. I would say they're going to do everything that they've been doing with gold, but I'll say this in a positive light. Even with gold, it doesn't work anymore. And if it doesn't work with gold anymore and Bitcoin is better, if you think Bitcoin is better, I'm not debating that, then they're not going to keep Bitcoin down forever as well. That's the bottom line. I mean, China basically said to the U.S., gold is more valuable than treasuries. And that's where this all comes back to the ECB making that announcement. So if they can't control gold, then, you know, maybe they can't control Bitcoin either. They can only slow it down. They can't stop it. That's what I think.
Yeah. So what is the latest with gold markets? We're trading at 4,325 right now, down from about 5, wicked up to 5.5. Are we just in a consolidation? I mean, the last time you came on, you were talking about silver. It was running too hot. It was crazy.
Yeah.
That we were hitting those levels. Cold. There was probably going to be a cool off. And
yeah,
that did play out. And so what is happening in the precious metals complex right now?
Well, the gold market is, everybody's talking about the gold market at the mainstream media level. Everyone's talking about the gold market as, oh, dollar diversification, central banks are buying, but that's known now. That's in the market. So we need another catalyst for gold to get a leg higher. And that catalyst will probably be something that comes out of Bessent's mouth, maybe a revaluation. I mean, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but people are starting to talk about it a lot more. Maybe a gold bond, that's being talked about again. But what's going on in the gold market right now is for two and a half years, we gold bugs had the luxury of a market that didn't care about the dollar, of a market that didn't care about rates, of a market that didn't care about anything except they wanted the gold. We want the gold. We're going to buy the gold. Why? Because we don't want treasuries anymore. Now, for whatever reason, gold is now being priced in dollars again. Gold is being priced compared to rates again. If oil goes up, people are not buying gold because they think the Fed's going to raise rates. So it's not inflation. People are talking about inflation being the reason that gold's dropping. That's not true. The reason gold's dropping is because the marketplace thinks the Fed's going to fight inflation this time, and I don't think it will. So I'm buying the next. I'm buying a dip pretty soon.
When you say fight inflation, you mean effectively fight inflation?
Well, not effectively. I mean wave a magic wand at it by raising rates. I mean, the last time the Fed fought inflation was in 2022. And I'll give an example that's parallel. We're talking about the Middle East war, the Iran war, and we're talking about dollar strength undermining gold's viability. Well, I'll give you a story from 2022. In 2022, the Ukraine war started, and gold spiked near all-time highs. That was in February. Then in March, the Fed announced they were going to raise rates. And gold marched for 6 months, 5 months, April, May, June, July, August, September, red candles in a row. Bitcoin took it on the chin then too. And that was them effectively fighting inflation. But remember, you know, Powell said he wanted to get it back to 2%. We're almost at 4% now. So your question is, are they going to genuinely fight inflation? No, they're just going to wave a magic wand at it. They always err on the side of tolerating inflation as opposed to recession. And that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, if you look at the latest PPI, that was well over expectations. That's usually a leading indicator. Oh, yeah. You look at oil, I mean, it's trading right below 90. right now, but I had Chris Martinson on last week, and that was one of his points was like, you can make the argument that oil is relatively depressed because we're draining SPRs globally, and once you can't drain those anymore, we're going to feel the real supply chain disruption shock, which should
send
it higher. And he had a deadline of like June 15th or July 15th, one of the two, for a resolution in Iran. If you don't get a resolution by then, it's going to get really bad.
Well, you know, Chris is a great guy. I love, I've spoken with him many times. One of the things about the SPR drainage is it's, and this is not going to take away from his point, is it's not really a drainage. They take it out in the front, and then the oil company that gets the oil has to pay it back a year later. So all we're doing is kicking the can. We're printing oil. We're kicking the can down the road like we do with everything else. And so this will come back to bite us in the ass. SPRs in the long run never really work. In the short run, they manage expectations. And we'll see what happens after the midterm when he stops that. There are two other events. Now, I'm a lot older than you. So I lived through the 70s. As a kid, a little kid, I didn't know what was going on, but I was living through it. And during the 70s, there were two things that happened at the same time that our history is kind of repeating itself. We had in Philadelphia. In 1976, Philadelphia was the city for the All-Star Game. And I grew up in South Philly. And every day during that year, 1976, Philadelphia was the cleanest city on earth. You could have eaten off the streets. Everybody was working. Everybody was everything was clean. The point is, the federal government pulled out all the stops to make Philadelphia look good for the bicentennial. 1977, the inflation started. And that's what's happening now. Now, we are doing, what's it called? The semi-quincentennial, 250-year celebration. Mm-hmm. That's going to be inflationary. We're holding a party, and that's going to spend money. And on top of that, what's worse than 76 is we have the FIFA World Cup. FIFA World Cup is inflationary. Like, there's no way they can control inflation without crushing the stock market, and they will not crush the stock market. So to Chris's point, yeah, oil's not going back down. If it's going down today, it's going up tomorrow. We've got the FIFA World Cup starting, and that's in mid-June. And we've got this semi-quincentennial celebration. We're going to be pulling out all the stops and printing $250 bills. So this is not going to be – this inflation is not controllable. I don't think it's controllable. The only thing that can control it is if everybody were to deploy AI overnight and get everyone fired so you have automated baristas. Well, if you have automated baristas, then you have unemployment at 10%. So they're trying to go back to that to the controlled takedown. They're trying to thread a needle. They're trying to change an engine in a car. They're like, we have to tolerate inflation just like they are in Europe. They have to tolerate inflation in Europe because they need to build their own defenses. I agree with Chris. I don't see how it could get any better. But it's reminding me of 1976 when I was a kid. I remember turning to my dad, just to give you an idea, like how naive I was. I was at the All-Star game. My father took me to the All-Star game in 76. And the streets were so clean. I mean, as a little kid, I was like, wow, this is great. And I turned to my dad. I said, Dad, I was like 10 years old. I was like, Dad, does this mean Philadelphia is going to be the capital of the country again? And he said, no, next year we're all going to be broke. And he was right. That's it. My father's business shut down 3 years later after that.
Really? What kind of business was it?
It was that we had pasta and pizza. It was a complete Italian wok place. We local neighborhood, pasta, pizza, spaghetti, ravioli, Italian, like an Italian deli.
Yeah. I can't find it. But I'm looking for the chart of inflation from, I believe, 2020 overlaid with the 1970s echo inflation, and we're tracking pretty tightly with that right now.
Yeah. In fact, we're tracking. I think the last time I looked at it, depending on whose chart you're looking at, we're at 1975. which means we get another year of good stuff. And then inflation upticks since 1977 to 79 all over again. But it's a great chart. It's going to be coming back and being very popular soon, I think.
Well, and it makes you wonder, like, how can we react to it? I mean, obviously you had Volcker in the 70s who was able to jack rates up to 18%, but we can't stomach that with the interest expense. It's like, what are we going to do?
I don't know. Maybe a war. Maybe we do have a kinetic, you know, world war type of situation where somebody just loses it and it happens. But if we can't raise rates, I guess maybe we deploy the robots, you know, deploy the AI robots.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think we're very much aligned on that thought. It's like the threading the needle comes with many different variables that need to line up. And one of them is a somewhat controlled productivity miracle via AI in the agentic digital workforce, and then in the robotic physical workforce. And
that's right. I mean, we're not going to do it. We don't want unemployment to go too high, so we're not going to do it. Meanwhile, in China, they're kicking our ass in robots. And AI, in my opinion, AI is more of a physical thing than a large language model, a learning language model. I think the robots, when the robots are deployed, that's like Europe is importing immigrants to solve their lack of work. China is building robots to solve their lack of work. Now, I'm not pro-China. I'm not bullish China. But their solution is to embrace the AI and I guess give everyone UBI over there. Our solution is going to have to be the same thing. AI brings UBI. If you deploy AI, then you create UBI, which is basically inflation. So I don't know how we get around it.
Yeah, and I mean, you see, I was actually talking about this on a show this morning, like the horseshoe theory playing out. You have Bernie Sanders calling for the U.S. to get a 50% stake in the AI hyperscalers so that they can roll those revenues to the federal government. And then Donald Trump saying something similar as well.
Oh, yeah. Trump's a Democrat. He's not a Democrat. What he is he's an old school corporatist, and old school corporatists are they hate government when he wasn't president. They hate government, but they're always looking to get a deal with the government. That's the old school corporatist. That's the Rockefeller. That's the J.P. Morgan types. So I hate the government. I hate the government. And they're always cutting a deal with the government. So now you got the your horseshoe concept of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Policy wise, they're the same person.
As it pertains to the book and the content of the book, what should we tell the audience that we haven't covered already?
Well, I think a lot of people want to know who the book is for, because it's not a thick book. You can read it in one day, one sitting. The book is written for people who know something important is changing in the monetary system, but can't quite explain what it is. So you don't need a finance degree. I explain repo markets, reserve assets, collateral chains in plain English. The goal is to help readers understand the plumbing that sits behind the headlines. I mean, look, if there's one takeaway I want someone to get from this after they read that book, is that money gets all the attention, but collateral does all the work. And that's it.
You don't hear people talking about collateral as much as they're talking about money.
Too many syllables, because you don't carry around the collateral of gold or treasury in your pocket. You carry around a dollar bill. Money is easier to say. Money has all the marketing.
It does. Money, cash rules everything around me. Cream.
Right.
Dollar bill, y'all. I'm not very brushed up on my Wu-Tang Clan, but.
Don't worry, it's not lost on me.
That's one thing that my Bitcoin journey fortunately has educated me about is collateral in the system, how it works. And I completely agree with you, where everybody's focused on currency.
Well, that's the charter situation. I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, but you know, I forget the guy's name. But when you look at banking from the way bankers look at it, there really is no collateral. It's really a unit of account and medium of exchange. And the collateral is trust. So if you can remove the need for trust, You don't need a shiny metal object. You don't need a treasury. You have the unit of account become the store of value. And so that is the concept behind Bitcoin, where the network is the money. So I understand it.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing, Vince. Thank you for your time. We'll link to the book in the show notes, and I will make sure to find the Tim Hortons man who was convinced to euthanize himself, so you can share with your readers, because I think it's an important message to get out there.
Thank you.
There's insanity everywhere.
Thanks for having me on, Marty. Good to see you again.
Always a pleasure, sir. Peace and love, freaks.
Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free, helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time, and until next time.